Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Tetragon Financial Group Investor Call. All participant lines are on mute. If anyone should require operator assistance during the call, press star, then zero on your telephone. I would now like to hand over to the chairperson, David Wyshnor. Please begin your meeting, and I will be standing by.
Thanks, Catherine. As one of the principals of the investment manager at Tetragon Financial Group Limited, I'd like to welcome you to our investor call, which will focus on Q1 2011 results and provide an update on business progress to date. The format of today's call will be similar to prior calls. Phil Bland, our CFO, will present Tetragon's Q1 results. I'll provide a quick overview on our portfolio and key performance metrics. Mike Rosenberg will provide market color, and then we will address questions we have received in the Q&A portion of the call. I'd like to remind everyone that the following contains forward-looking comments, including statements regarding the intentions, beliefs, or current expectations concerning performance and financial condition on the products and markets in which Tetragon invests. Our performance may change materially as a result of various possible events or factors. With that, let me now turn the call over to Phil.
That's great. Thanks very much, David, and welcome to our Q1 call. As usual, I'd like to start by providing some high-level comments on TFG's results for the quarter, which are contained in our recently published quarterly report. I'll also talk about some key performance drivers and through that try to address some financial questions that have been submitted by investors. As in the past, further detailed questions on our financial disclosures can be sent to us, and we will endeavour to answer them directly wherever possible. So to the quarter's results, TFG delivered a very strong first quarter of 2011, achieving its seventh successive quarter of positive EPS in the process. EPS was $1.47 per share, which is equivalent to consolidated net income of $175.1 million, whilst cash generation from the portfolio grew quarter on quarter by approximately 15% to $90.9 million. And consolidated NAV per share, net of all fees and expenses, ended the quarter at $10.85, which is a new high for TFG. Moving to the statement of operations, in general, the underlying positives were a continuation on the theme of recent quarters, namely that the CLOs mainly benefited from strengthening OC cushions, supported by reduced underlying losses, increased carrying prices on defaulted and triple C assets, and a reduction in triple C asset levels. As a result, future projected cash flows increased significantly, and IRRs moved up accordingly from a portfolio-weighted average level of 15.1% to 15.8%. Interest income from investments of $48.5 million, plus unrealized gains on investments of $184.5 million, yielded a total investment income number of $233 million. Comfortably exceeding Q4's number of $175 million, and this, I guess unsurprisingly, is TFG's highest to date. The primary drivers of this performance were the positive fundamentals that I outlined a moment ago, but there was also an increase in income as a result of a recalibration of the discount rates applied in our fair value process, which I'll now turn to in the context of the Q1 valuation of the portfolio. As we've described in more detail on pages 10 to 12 of the Q1 report, the methodology for deriving a fair value of the CLO portfolio involves two main steps. Firstly, we project future cash flows and calculate the IRR on each deal using an independent market standard modeling tool, which contains the current status of each deal and to which certain future assumptions are applied. With regards to this first modeling step, our key forward assumptions, which include defaults, recoveries, prepayments, and reinvestment prices, were unchanged versus those used at the end of 2010. And indeed, we continue to outperform those metrics on a portfolio basis, as David will discuss in more detail later. In step two of our fair value process, we adjust the future cash flows resulting from the first step using a discount rate, which we believe reflects an appropriate risk premium. Generally speaking, if the discount rate is higher than the IRR, the fair value of a deal will be written down to below its amortized cost, and of course, vice versa. The difference between the total amortized cost and the fair value on an aggregate basis across the CLO portfolio is what we've described as the ALR fair value adjustment, which we've explained in some detail on prior calls. The total ALR fair value adjustment between the amortized cost and fair value at the end of the quarter was $155.7 million, of which approximately $60 million related to the US deals, and the remainder, of course, related to the Euro deals. Given that the Euro deals account for approximately 12% of the portfolio's fair value, this demonstrates how far the US deals continue to be ahead of the Euro deals in the recovery cycle. I'd now like to discuss how we derive the appropriate discount rates for Q1, which we've described in some detail in the report itself. Over the course of the quarter, observable risk premia in the CLO space continued to decline, albeit not as steeply as in the previous quarter. In Q4, as we reported, we'd not adjusted the discount rates in reaction to the declines we saw, as we'd wanted to ensure that these declines were sustainable. This sustainability proved to be the case as the spreads on BB and BBB rated CLO tranches continued to reduce and indeed compress over the quarter as a whole. In response to this reduction and compression of spreads, the discount rates were adjusted from 23% to 20% for the strong deals and from 30% to 25% for the remainder. With approximately 80% of our deals now in the stronger category, the weighted average discount rate is approximately 21% as a result of the changes. I think it's worth noting that whilst these changes are significant, reflecting as they do the broader reduction in CLO risk premium over the last 6 months, they were not actually the main driver of performance in the quarter. Indeed, 61% of the quarter's net income came from deal performance, excluding the changes to the discount rates that I've just outlined above. To finish off the section on CLO valuation, I just want to touch on the final part of our valuation process, which is to check the resulting values against observable market prices where they are available. It's worth stressing again that the values of our portfolio deals cover a fairly broad span, which reflects the range of individual deals' performance levels, and that market data for TFG's paper remains patchy, as it is across the market. That being said, our average carrying cost across the US CLOs, which account for over 90% of the portfolio by fair value, was approximately 75 cents the end of the quarter, up from around 67 cents at the end of December. We feel this significant increase partly reflects the fact that our Q4 valuation may have been lagging behind market improvements, but mainly reflects the continued improvement in our own portfolio and in CLOs in general. In addition, there is observable evidence of certain CLO equity paper transacting at levels notably higher than our average carrying value, and it's something that we continue to monitor in the context of validating our own fair values. In general, we continue to seek to value TFG's portfolio at the conservative end of a reasonable range. Turning from valuation now to other aspects of the operating performance of TFG, our operating expenses, including performance fees and taxes on LCM's results, totaled $65.6 million. And that represents around 27% of total income and gains, which is pretty much unchanged on the previous quarter, so very stable. Turning briefly to cash, the cash generated by the portfolio continued to improve, and that reflects, among other things, the strong underlying portfolio performance, which David will provide more color on in a moment. Total cash receipts were approximately $90.9 million, and that equates to 76 cents per weighted average share, which is the highest quarterly cash receipt for almost 3 years. Whilst cash receipts will not necessarily be exactly even quarter on quarter, we would expect, absent any market disruptions or other material external developments, that cash receipts next quarter to be in a similar ballpark range. Finally, LCM continued to grow its top line income in the first quarter, and that's largely due to a reflection of full quarter fees from LCM8, plus the additional deal which was acquired through a corporate action in Q4. The plan is to continue to seek opportunities to add business into LCM, as well as to utilize their team's considerable credit expertise across other aspects of TFG's business. So to summarize this this section, we're extremely pleased with the financial results for the quarter, which come on the back of extra results for 2010. The drivers of performance have continued to center on strong earnings from strengthening deals and growth in cash generation from the portfolio and LCM against a backdrop of generally improving market fundamentals. And with that, I'll pass back to David to comment on TFG's portfolio and risk profile.
Thanks, Bill. Let me now quickly run you through a few portfolio and performance metrics that we're focused on. The weighted average IRR of TFG's CLO portfolio ended Q1 at 15.8%, up from 15.1% at the end of Q4. This result reflected, among other things, continued gains in the underlying credit quality, assumption outperformance, and excess interest availability. As requested by our investors, our deal-by-deal portfolio stats are available on a no-names basis in our quarterly release. With the addition of four secondary U.S. CLO equity purchases, totaling $13.8 million, the CLO portfolio increased to 74 transactions during the quarter, up from 70 deals as of the end of Q4. The number of external CLO managers remained stable at 28. As the four new CLO equity positions that were purchased were add-on positions to previously underwritten deals. As of the end of Q1, the fair value of TFG's CLO investment portfolio was approximately $1.1 billion, up from approximately $933 million as of the end of 2010. On a look-through basis, this represents exposure to leveraged loans through our CLO investments of approximately $17.8 billion of par value spread across over 1,700 corporate obligors, the substantial majority of which are U.S. names, with the balance being European. Additionally, as of Q1 quarter end, TFG owned liquid U.S. bank loans with an aggregate par amount of approximately $105 million, and a total fair value of $103.2 million. This is up from $97.6 million TFG owned as of the end of 2010. This portfolio is comprised of over 40 issuers. The unlevered loan portfolio continued to perform well, benefiting from improvements in credit quality as well as strong technical loan market conditions. No defaults or downgrades were experienced. Since inception, this direct loan portfolio has generated over $5.2 million in trading gains and interest proceeds. We expect to continue to selectively deploy capital into direct loans when appropriate and leverage the expertise of the LCM team in this regard where possible. With respect to the CLO and loan portfolio composition, approximately 72% of the risk capital is invested in U.S. broadly syndicated loans, 12.8% in European loans, and the balance, 15.2%, in U.S. middle market loans. We continue to hold hedges against our Euro FX principal risk on a rolling basis and presently have no direct credit hedges on the portfolio. We have also begun to deploy certain inflation protection hedges designed to provide the portfolio protection if we should face such an environment. Jeff will provide more detail on this approach in the Q&A portion of the call. I'd like to now update you on some key performance metrics that we are also focused on. TFG's lagging 12-month corporate loan default rate decreased from the end of 2010 to an annualized 1.1% during the first quarter, equaling the 12-month lagging institutional U.S. loan default rate as reported by S&P. At the end of Q1, 98% of TFG's CLO investments were passing their most junior OC test when evaluated on a percentage of fair value. When measured on a percentage of transactions basis, 63 deals, or 95% of the company's CLO investments, were passing their most junior OC test, an increase from 94% at the end of Q4. Or said another way, one additional deal began passing its most junior OC test during the first quarter. TFG's U.S. CLOs, representing 86% of the overall fair value through Q4, continue to perform very well, with 100% by both fair value and number of transactions, passing their most junior OC tests. At the end of Q1, the weighted average percentage of corporate obligors rated triple C or below fell to 7.8% from 8.3% at the end of Q4. In comparison, the Q1 market-wide median triple C asset holding of U.S. CLOs was estimated to be 8.3%. Also of note, TFG's weighted average rating factor is slightly lower at 2,664 versus 2,671 at the end of Q4. Let me now hand it over to Mike to provide some color on the present loan market conditions and outlook, and then we'll move into the Q&A portion of the call.
Thanks, Dave. The general CLO market conditions remain quite positive, as evidenced by strong deal performance, solid underlying credit fundamentals, strong financing markets, and CLO debt spreads continuing to grind tighter. The first quarter witnessed very strong refinancing volumes and leveraged loans, resulting in an all-time high quarterly prepayment rate of 17.7% in the U.S. Due to the refinancing volume, in addition to amend and extend activities, the maturity wall in leveraged loan market has been significantly reduced. In 2008, the cumulative amount of leveraged loans maturing through the end of 2014 was $745 billion. As of the end of March 2011, this maturity wall has been reduced to only $376 billion. While the refinancing activity has led to some spread compression for the underlying leveraged loans, it has remained relatively muted, with average all-in spreads of double B and single B new issue loans priced to yield LIBOR plus 400 basis points and LIBOR plus 500 basis points, respectively, which is still well wide of historical measures. I would note, however, that anecdotal evidence shows continued spread compression. With respect to the new issue CLO market, from an equity perspective, we believe transactions are becoming more attractive as AAA spreads continue to grind tighter. A recent CLO priced its AAAs at a yield of LIBOR plus 130 basis points compared to the LCM 8 transaction that was completed in November 2010, with AAAs being priced to yield LIBOR plus 160 basis points. Assuming 10 times leverage and all else being equal, the 30 basis point drop in AAA spreads would result in almost a 300 basis point increase to expected equity returns. We generally expect AAAs to continue to grind tighter as demand seems to have picked up, mostly from insurance companies globally, pension funds, and certain Japanese investors re-entering the market for CLO AAA debt. As Dave mentioned earlier, overall conditions remain positive, with default rates dropping to 1.1% as of the end of the first quarter, leading to strong deal performance. Now, while market conditions remain positive for existing CLOs and new issue volume has increased, there is some uncertainty regarding the effect of the implementation of the proposed risk retention rules in the U.S. and Europe. In brief summary, a CLO manager may be effectively required to retain a portion of the credit risk in the underlying portfolio, a likely outcome being that the CLO manager would retain a significant portion of the equity tranche of a transaction. It's too early to fully understand the implication of the retention rules. However, one outcome may be a reduction in the number of CLO managers in the market, particularly ones without the ability to commit the capital necessary to meet the retention requirements. The proposed risk retention rules in the U.S. are currently under a comment period until June 2011, and a final ruling is expected by the end of the third quarter 2011, with implementation not expected until 2013. Now I'd like to move to the Q&A section of the call. We received a couple of questions related to our Green Oak real estate investment, and in particular, possible real estate funds focused on Japan. As a reminder, the minority stake in Green Oak investment is part of TFG's commitment to its current strategy of expanding its asset management platform and diversifying its income streams. And TFG continues its transformation into a broad-based financial services firm that both holds investments and owns interest in multiple operating businesses across various asset classes. We also continue to explore asset classes beyond the leveraged loan market, such as real estate. In particular, Green Oak continues to explore the possibility of raising an investment fund focused on Japan, but such plans have been delayed given the recent earthquake and tsunami disaster, and no purchases of real estate assets in Japan have been made to date. Accordingly, TFG currently has no funds committed to invest in real estate in Japan. However, Green Oak is currently executing on numerous advisory assignments and is continuing to evaluate funds in select markets where the Green Oak founders and local teams have deep, long-standing market presence, access, and experience. We expect to be able to announce TFG's first allocation of capital to Green Oak in our Q2 results. As reported previously, we currently do not expect to see operating income benefits from the Green Oak venture in the immediate future, as it is a medium-term investment. Now I'm going to pass it back over to Phil to talk about the questions related to the dividends.
Thanks very much, Mike. Several people have asked about getting some additional color around the company's strategy vis-a-vis dividends. We've always stated that we want the dividend to be meaningful and fully understand that dividend yield is recognized as one of several factors considered by potential investors. We also feel that the quality, by which we mean the sustainability and stability of the dividend stream over time, is considered to be very important. After a significant reduction in our dividend to 3 cents per share at the height of the financial crisis, since Q4 2009, you'll have seen that we've doubled the dividend to 6 cents and then increased it steadily through the recovery period. So 2 quarters at 8 cents, followed by 2 quarters now at 9 cents. Although recent performance has been excellent, as the portfolio and the business generally have emerged strongly from the financial crisis, we and the board carefully consider, among other things, the sustainability of dividends over the economic cycle, and assess the dividend alongside other uses of cash. We'll continue to seek to create shareholder value through a package of a meaningful dividend, an active share buyback program, which will be covered in a bit more detail later, to provide liquidity in the stock, but also other investment opportunities, some of which have already been alluded to by Mike. Well, that'll pass back to David to pick up on the share buyback.
We've received a few questions in regards to the share buyback program. The current program remains active and runs till October 2011, at which point we would expect to renew the buyback program. To date, we have purchased just under 12 million shares at an average price of $4.47 per share. Under the present program, we have approximately 4.7 million shares permitted to be purchased. Such purchases may, at appropriate price levels below NAV, represent an attractive use of TFG's excess cash and an efficient means to return cash to shareholders. There's also been a fair amount of focus on cash flow and expected cash flow from the TFG portfolio. For 2010, TFG received approximately $261 million of gross cash. Following the improvement in the portfolio discussed earlier, in Q1 2011, the company received approximately $91 million of cash for the quarter. Absent some market and macroeconomic changes or other significant event, we would expect cash flows in the coming quarter to reflect the same improving market conditions, subject to quarter-on-quarter variability. For comparison's sake, in 2008, which was a relatively benign default period, TFG received approximately $343 million of gross cash flow. A question was also asked about our media and PR efforts. We have an active PR campaign that includes Sard Verbinnen in the U.S. and Brunswick Group in the U.K. We have meaningful relationships with both mainstream financial press and more specific industry-tailored news outlets like Credit Flux, SCI, et cetera. We're frequent panel participants at loan and credit industry conferences as well. We have two firms presently covering TFG, and we are hopeful of adding a third within a few months. We were also asked about the fact that TFG shares traded at a discount to NAV. We believe that the company has the potential to trade above NAV with meaningful liquidity in its shares. Average daily trading volume is up significantly from 2010, and liquidity in the shares continues to improve. We believe that the company pays a competitive, above-market dividend and have had a share buyback in place for close to 3 years. We also continue to lead in the new issue CLO market. Purchased, in our view, an industry-leading loan manager in LCM, and continue to pursue strategic acquisitions that could further evolve the company into more of a business that owns interest in operating companies as opposed to strictly a portfolio company, and further diversify the company's income stream. We think all of these efforts have the potential to contribute to shares trading at book value, if not a premium. With that, let me turn it over to Jeff to focus on the macro environment.
Thanks, Dave. We have received some questions regarding how changing rate environment, specifically a rising interest rate environment, may have an effect on TFG's performance and how we might protect against any adverse effects. There are several ways in which our CLO equity portfolio could be affected, all other things being equal, by a rising interest rate environment. It can be roughly separated by interest rate effects on the CLO structure itself, and the effects on the asset quality of our portfolio, i.e. the borrower's credit quality. A gradual, moderate rise in interest rates, and here I'm referring to short-term LIBOR rates, they have a slightly positive effect on CLO equity returns. This is because CLOs are match-funded in that the majority of underlying loan assets and the liabilities that finance our assets are based on similar short-term LIBOR rates. So an increase in our LIBOR rates based on an increase in short-term LIBOR is directly offset by an increase in the rates on our income-producing assets. I say a majority because the capital structure of a CLO consists of, for example, approximately 92% debt and 8% equity. Therefore, the equity of a CLO is a LIBOR-based floating return. So as LIBOR rates move higher, equity returns move higher as well. Some of this potential benefit is already included in the current forward LIBOR curve in our model projections, but should rates move higher than is currently reflected in the forward curve, our returns could benefit. Outside of the CLO structure, rising interest rates may also affect the ability of our borrowers to service their debt. With approximately half of our borrowers' debt being floating rate, a rising interest rate environment could reduce a borrower's interest coverage, weakening their credit quality and potentially leading to a credit rating downgrade or missed interest payment. There are some potential mitigants to higher rates leading to weaker credit, which have been observed in the past. First, borrowers are generally required to hedge a substantial portion of their floating rate debt into fixed rate debt to reduce the effect the higher rates may have on their ability to service debt payments. And secondly, generally speaking, through past cycles, a high interest rate environment is usually associated with a strong economy or inflation, which would likely produce higher revenue for borrowers and thus an increase in interest coverage that may offset the decline in coverage due to higher interest rates. So while we believe that a higher rate environment will generally not have a significant effect on our CLO portfolio, we do feel that there is a scenario characterized by extreme inflation or deflation that leads to unusually high interest rates that may have a greater impact on our borrowers' debt service coverage than we have observed in the past, especially given the environment that we have just come through with high amounts of government intervention and correspondingly high levels of government debt. While we acknowledge that this is an extreme scenario, we also view the cost to protect against such a scenario to be commensurate with the likelihood of it occurring, i.e., the risk-reward ratio is attractive. Therefore, we have been evaluating and have begun to execute an interest rate option hedge strategy that we believe will help protect our CLO portfolio against an extreme movement higher in rates. We continue to evaluate these risks and may opportunistically increase this hedging strategy going forward. As most of you know on this call, we greatly value direct one-on-one communication with our investor base. The products that we invest in require a fair amount of explanation, are complex, and are structured by nature. We expect to continue this combination of the current format for investor calls and extensive one-on-one communications to ensure that our investors are fully and directly informed. That brings an end to the Q&A portion of the call. We'd like to thank everyone for joining. As always, please do not hesitate to contact us with any further questions, and we look forward to speaking to you in the future. Thanks.
Gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect your lines. Thank you and goodbye.